For some background, the Dallas Mexican American Historical League, DMHAL, is a 501c3 organization dedicated to researching, collecting, and preserving the historical and cultural experiences of Mexican Americans in Dallas from the early 1900s to the present.
Through DMHAL, the Emerging Historian Cohort is a contingent of young professionals assembled by DMHAL lifetime member Rosemary Hinojosa in order to pass on the legacy of preserving our local history to the next generation of historians. Hinojosa, in order to pass on the legacy of preserving our local history to the next generation of historians.
Aquí estamos, porque acá fue donde nos puso la vida. Dejé todo, mis amigos, mi familia y mi ilusión. Y aunque allá he pasado los mejores años de mi vida, decir esto da tristeza, pero acá estamos mejor. Pero acá estamos mejor.
In this episode of the Chronicles of Dallas Audios podcast, Victoria Ferrell-Ortiz interviews Jonathan Angulo. Jonathan is currently a PhD candidate at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. His research focuses on the history of the Imperial and Mexicali Valley in the California borderlands, which he grew up in. He observes how immigration and the intersection between the formal and gig economy affected the Asian and Mexican communities along the U.S.-Mexico borderlands between 1917 and 1980. He enjoys participating in oral history projects because they help create records from the perspective of often neglected populations. He currently serves as a board member for the Dallas Mexican American Historical League and the Hispanic Alumni of SMU. If you have any firsthand accounts of family or friends or yourself even of your migration story, could you share them, Jonathan?
Yeah, I can talk about my family's immigration story. My parents, Maria Angulo and Miguel Angulo, they were both born in the state of Sinaloa. My mom was born in Guasave, Sinaloa. And my dad was born in Culiacán, Sinaloa. They both married relatively young. And my mom would hang out a lot with her sister in Culiacán, Sinaloa. And my dad worked for, I forgot the name of the company, but it was like a company that fixed agricultural machinery in Sinaloa. He, in order to, alleviate like my family's economic condition, because they had my sister when they were like after they got married, he purchased like a, I think it's called like a Rome operator or something. But it's like the machine that like picks up like hay. And he traveled to Baja California with the equipment during like seasonal harvests. And he sold, like those bales of hay and stuff like that. And he would also fix like that equipment like on the side too to get some extra money. So he would often like, travel between Sinaloa and Baja California doing that kind of work. And my mom, she focused on raising my brother and my sister. My sister, who's the eldest, Jessica Ovando, and my older brother, Miguel Angulo Jr. They grew up in Culiacán, Sinaloa, and my mom, she took him to school and stuff like that. And then she also, worked and tried to like, help out with like financial stuff at home. My dad kept on doing this. And then I believe he started because he couldn't acquire like that much money. He started coming to the United States as an undocumented immigrant and working in Los Angeles. And yeah, so he would like do that like a lot, right? And he like, if he said like that he ended up going to like a detention center in El Centro, California, which is where I was born. And he talks about like, you know, being in the, or being in the detention process. And yeah, like he got really tired of like, you know, having to do work in agriculture and being an undocumented immigrant. So when the U.S. Congress passed in 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, it allowed like a path to a documented status. So my dad took that opportunity to come to the United States and file for residency status so he could get his residency. And my family moved to Mexicali, Baja California. And he was able to fix my mom's status too in Calexico, California, through an immigration lawyer. And then after that, my brother and my sister, he couldn't fix their status. So they crossed into the United States under undocumented status. And then, you know, I was born in 1992. And then, yeah, we just all stayed there. And throughout the years, like my brother and my sister were able to become permanent residents. And now they're all United States citizens, my brother, my sister, my mom, and my dad. So, yeah, I mean, that's an example of a migration story about my family. So, yeah.
That's interesting to hear of all the obstacles that your parents overcame through their journey, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I was they definitely could provide a lot more concrete examples. I mean, like I recorded them, like I did an oral history with both of them. And obviously I didn't go into detail like everything that they went through, but they went through a lot of hardships. But yeah.
For me, my grandmother has a really unique story because her family is from, part of them are from Nuevo Laredo, and it's a border town. And whenever her mother was pregnant with her, her dad decided to go back to Mexico for work. She was born there and they lived there for a little bit, but then her dad moved back to Cement City, to Cemento Grande, the Trinity Portland Cement Company town, where my ancestors are from here in Dallas, in West Dallas. Because of my abuela being born in Mexico at the time, they weren't letting Mexican nationals into Texas, and she was kind of stuck there. My great-grandfather and my great-grandmother were both like U.S. citizens. But they were like, I think they identified as like Tejanos. But so my abuela's mother was stuck with her because she didn't want to leave her behind. And eventually whenever she was 15, she came and she posed as someone else's daughter who had a passport and was around the same age as my grandma. And that's how she got across. There are a few years that she was living with a family friend because my great-grandmother's mother got sick and she had heard that she wasn't being well taken care of. And so she needed to come home to take care of her mother as she passed. So that was tough on my grandma while she waited to like figure out how to get here with the rest of her family. But yeah, and then my great-grandmother was very adamant that she wouldn't just send my abuela with like a coyote or whatever, mm-hmm. because she was afraid that she would be taken advantage of, you know. And so that's why it ended up with them waiting to find someone who they trusted who could get her across. And then eventually, like, my Wella's lived here for her life since then. Mm-hmm. And whenever Reagan allowed a pathway to citizenship, that's how she became a resident.
Mm, that's super interesting. Yeah, my brother and my sister kind of like were in the same situation because my mom and my dad weren't comfortable. Okay, so my brother came into the country with the help of a coyote. So my dad paid for a person to do that service in the region that I grew up in, the Imperial Valley, located in Southeastern California. That's when, you know, the border wasn't like super constructed as it is today. So I remember like in the 90s he crossed in like the late 80s, but, you know, I remember like in the 90s where like the border was, I don't know what it's called in English, but it's like triplay. So it's like that sheet metal. So they would have beams and sheet metal, right? So you could hear the little noise of sheet metal whenever it was like really windy. And it wasn't like as high either. So the coyote, like my dad paid for the coyote to toss my brother over. he had other people waiting for them like on the other side, right? But anyways, like going back to, I believe it was your grandmother who was, you know, who crossed the border using somebody else's documents, right? Yeah, that's how my sister crossed too. Like my mom and my dad weren't comfortable crossing her through a coyote, and somebody that they knew in the community said, well, hey, you know, your daughter kind of looks like me. So we'll use like my documents so they can like, so she can be in the vehicle with us and we can cross her like that, right? And at that point too, Border Patrol wasn't as, how do I put it? Like they weren't as obstructive or not obstructive, but they weren't as like focused on asking as many questions as they do now. So they would just ask you like, hey, are you a United States citizen? And then you would just show your documents if you were one, or if you're a resident, you know, she just showed them and she was able to come in like that. So it's super interesting, right? Cause like these stories talk about how people like move across the border throughout the 20th century in similar ways, right? It's still happening today.
Yeah, my grandma, my abuela is 87. She was, let me do math. She was born in 1930.
1930?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, dang. 91? But also there's some confusion about that because she has a memory of somebody telling her that she was born in 1931, but then her document that she has says 1930. So
record. That's the son of my mom.
Really?
Yeah, my mom has two birthdays. She has like a birthday on October 30th and like November 4th, I think. And it's the same situation, right? Her documents, like in Mexico, say like one date, and then like her documents in the United States say like one date. So every year we ask her like, hey, which which date are you celebrating on?
Or she could do both.
Oh yeah, sometimes she says she's gonna do both.
That's funny. In hearing your story about your history about your brother, I kind of wondered how old he was, because I pictured him in my head being passed over that piece of metal, and I was wondering like how heavy he was, like did they you know?
Yeah, like he was probably like in his late, it was probably like when he was between like 7 to 10 probably. So he was like he was pretty young. Yeah, I can't remember it because like, so my sister is 40, she's 18 years older than me. So I'm 29 plus 18. Right, I'm doing math too. So she's 47 and my brother is 2 years younger than her. So 45. So 20, 21 minus 45. She was born 1976. So No, he was probably like a teenager. He was probably like maybe between 10 to 14. Yeah, so. Yeah, they must have been pretty strong. Yeah. So that's super interesting. I'm just like curious about your family, because you said that they identified as Tejano, right? So that they have like roots to like, I'm not sure if you might know this, but that they have like roots to some of like the Mexicans that maybe were involved during like the push for Texan independence, or is that kind of like lost in like the family history?
I don't know. Most of what we have is what I've been able to find. And my grandma's mom, Alejandra, was a Tejana, and my grandma's father, Ricardo, his name was Ricardo. He came to Cemento Grande, I think, during the Mexican Revolution.
Oh, okay.
So if that answers your question about like the Texas independence, but well, at least from his side, but for hers, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she could have like, so she was born in 1930, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so like she'd have to, I mean, like did her grandparents like live in Nuevo Laredo and like around that area?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've asked her and she didn't know her Mexican grandparents.
Oh, okay.
But the ones that lived at Cemento Grande, yeah. She knew her grandfather, but not her grandmother, because her grandmother passed away before she came to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they existed, and I just don't know that history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, the other way, like, you know, like, Tejano stayed in South Texas for a really long time. What's it called? You know, like, ever since, like, 1820 to like 1910, right, during like the Mexican Revolution, that displaced a lot of displaced and encouraged a lot of migration, right, because of the violence.
Yeah,
during the Mexican Revolution. Mm-hmm. So that's just like that's like super interesting, like just hearing like about, like, I'm pretty sure your mom or your grandma, like, you know, like had like insights about like how life was like in Nuevo Laredo, like during the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah, it was, so my grandma told me that Ricardo was fighting, which is why he decided to come over here. So, yeah, it was just, like, safer, I guess. And beyond that, that's all that she's, like, really disclosed.
Mm.
Yeah. But, do you think a lot of the reasons that your family decided to move were for economic prosperity?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, in like the course of like my research, right? Like studying the, again, like about the Mexican Revolution, right? Because like during that period, the Mexican Revolution, it was like really like a backlash against decades of rule by Porfirio Diaz, right? The Mexican president from like the mid or from like 1870, I think, to like the 1900s. During that period, Mexico had a lot of problems where like transnational companies that were in the United States, France, and England bought a lot. Well, not bought, you know, they stole land from Mexicans and indigenous communities throughout Mexico. And they created things like British Petroleum and extracted like the wealth from Mexico and didn't redistribute it to the communities like it should be, right? So the Mexican Revolution was like a backlash to that. And, you know, during the pivotal years of like 1910 to 1917 of the Mexican Revolution, you know, that formed the construction of like the Mexican Constitution. In the Mexican Constitution, one of the things that was in the Mexican Constitution was that border communities that were like, I think like between 50 to 100 miles between the border, like those lands could, the Mexican government had the right to take the land and property from like transnational companies and redistribute it to local communities. So like that transformative policy in the Mexican Constitution influenced one of like the Mexican presidents, Lázaro Cárdenas, which he's kind of like the equivalent to FDR in the United States. Lázaro Cárdenas like created, like helped like redistribute lands from like transnational companies and create like communal farms, or known as ejidos, to borderline communities. And he created, and right in that process, to acknowledging the damage that it did to like ethnic Asian communities, because along the borderlands, during the United States' pivot to exclude like ethnic Asian migration to the United States, Asian communities sought refuge in Mexico between like 1880 and 1930. And a lot of like Mexican xenophobia and discrimination because of the Great Depression like targeted Asian communities. So some of these Asian communities like owned land that belonged to like these transnational companies. So when the Mexican government like redistributed these lands, the ethnic Asian community like suffered, right? So they like had their lands like redistributed to Mexican communities. So just acknowledging that, right? Like that aspect of Mexican history. So when these ejidos were created, like Lázaro Cárdenas created these ejido banks. So these ejido banks could like lend money to people who had like agricultural land and developed, agricultural crops and stuff. So anyways, like when I was interviewing my dad, he was talking about how like in the 1970s, like these ejido farms or ejido banks were like, were being like defunded because of like austerity measures that Mexico was experiencing during the 1970s, right? Because Mexico experienced a period of like economic instability during the 1970s, kind of like during the Jimmy Carter presidency, right? Where the United States like experienced like rising inflation and rising unemployment. Mexico also experienced something along those lines, but it didn't really like hit until the 1990s. But the Mexican government started cutting back on government spending. So when my dad was talking about like, yeah, I remember like in the 1970s, like I could get like a loan from like the Ejido Bank and use it like for like my machinery or whatever. But like over time, like they stopped giving out these loans. So it was a lot harder for me to like fix my my equipment. It's like, so I had to like sell it or I couldn't use it anymore. So like that was one of the contributions that like he had to saw, or he had to like move to or migrate to the United States as an undocumented worker to be able to provide for like my family and stuff. But not only that, I mean, he also said that like he also wanted to move to the United States because like the education system was better. So he wanted like my brother and my sister to be able to like benefit from like the education system in the United States. And then, you know, during that time period too, you know, there was like that conception that the United States, there's a lot of more like economic opportunities and stuff like that in the United States. But, you know, over time, my dad like, you know, like became like very disillusioned because, you know, once we moved to the United States, like, yeah, like we were able to like pay for housing and food and stuff, but like my, we often like solicited services from like local, like nonprofits and stuff like that. Like there was like this place called Campesinos Unidos. And they like gave you vouchers to pay for like utility bills. So I remember like I'd wake up, like my mom would be like, yo, you need to wake up like at 8 o'clock in the morning and like call from like 8 to 9. And like, because like people would be calling and like the line would just like not go through. I could just be blocked. So like I'd have to like wake up at 8 and I'd call and I'd call and I'd call until somebody picked up. And then I'd be like, Amaya contestaron. Like I'd hear the phone. And then like she would so like, you know, sometimes we get like a fixed rate for like our utility bills because Campesinos Unidos would like take or offset the price or whatever. And then they also like really helped me out when I was in a school. Like they would like give me backpacks and stuff like that with school utilities and stuff. And then there was a period where we were able to like qualify for like food stamps and stuff like that. But later on, you know, like as welfare like requirements became like more stringent and stuff like that, like it was harder for like our family to get those services. But yeah, like my mom, like Like I always had like housing and food, but like it was like really hard for me to like ask my dad, like be like, hey, you know, like I want to go, like I want to buy like a $60 video game or something like that. He'd be like, no. But like he'd be like, if you want to go to like a movie like once like every month or something like that, then yeah, like I can give you some money. Or if you need like stuff to go like a school activity, then yeah, I'll give you some money. But anyways, that goes back to your question about like why my family like decided to like move over here. But yeah, like my dad was like, he'll say like, yeah, like, you know, like there was a lot more economic opportunities over here. But I think like one of the phrases that like people use is like the United States is like the jaula de oro. So it's pretty much like the, it's like the golden jail cell, right? Because you get like this idea about like United States being like this place where there's like economic prosperity and stuff like that. And then this didn't really apply for my family, but maybe for like mixed status families, right? They say it's like the jaula de oro, right? Because like you come to the United States and you, maybe you are able to get more money, but you can't go back to Mexico because you're an undocumented immigrant. And if you try to come back to the United States, you'll be like flagged for being an undocumented immigrant. Yeah. But anyways, yeah.
That was a great answer, Jonathan. You delved like deep into the history. I had a question about, or maybe it's just a comment, but I appreciated you talking about the businesses that along the border that were displaced whenever that land was divvied up and then divided among like Mexican nationals, right? It was just Mexican nationals. So like seeing that xenophobia and then how that was applied to Asian people in Mexico, and how it could be good for a Mexican national because you're, you know, being given this land and like thinking about what a blessing that is for you. But I wonder if like they also considered like, hey, this isn't, where did this come from? You know?
Yeah. You're talking about like the anti-Asian like discrimination, or what are you talking about? Or what are you referring to?
Yeah. So you said that there were Asian businesses along the border, right? And whenever the land was divvied up, to Mexican nationals, it made a huge land grab for that land that was businesses that were owned by Asian people, right? That lived here in Mexico, or was it just located here? But
so yeah, so like back where I was born and raised in the Imperial Valley, in Mexicali, it was like a cotton powerhouse. So at one period, it produced more cotton, if I remember correctly, from like studies that city or establishment, the pretty much like the capital city in Baja California, Mexicali, it produced almost as much cotton as like the United States South, or the southern region, right, of the United States. And because like the company, it was called the Colorado River Land Company. And the Colorado River Land Company like invested in Mexicali and the cotton cultivation. And they allowed like Asian farmers to become like tenant farmers and to be like farmers as well. And this occurred like during the 1910 to 1930, right? And then, you know, the Great Depression in 1929 to, you know, whenever we got out of it in 1940, it, you know, a lot of Mexicans like weren't able to provide for themselves in Mexicali. And you had all of the repatriates during the Great Depression go to Mexicali. So they would be in there and you'd be like, well, why are the, why is this Asian community able to prosper by like by selling cotton and stuff like that, right? So like between like 1930 to 1937, like all this like anti-Asian discrimination like built up. And in 1937, they coincided it with like the idea to like divvy up the Colorado River Land Company in this event called El Asalto de las Tierras. So it's pretty much translated to like the assault on the lands. And a whole bunch of like union, like agricultural union Mexicans like squatted on the land. And they said like, we're not going to like leave until like the federal government redistributes this land to us, right? And not only did they like squat on land that belonged to a U.S. company, the Colorado River Land Company, they also squatted on the land of Chinese and Japanese, like tenant farmers and farmers. And, you know, the Mexican federal government said like, well, you know, we're going to redistribute your land and give it to Mexicans. So like some of the Chinese and Japanese like community in Mexicali was like able to like work in other industries, like in the region, right? Like there's kind of like a Chinatown in Mexicali called, well, not kind of, there is, it's called the Chinesca in Mexicali. So like they were able to work in that kind of, or in that kind of like Chinatown in Mexicali. And even like today, like the Chinesca is still like prominent in Mexicali. It has like some of like the like businesses that sell like party goods and stuff like that. But there's still like a lot of like anti-Asian like discrimination, like not only in Mexicali, but in Mexico.
So in a nutshell, do you know if there's ever been a movement for reparations of that land?
I don't think there has, actually. Yeah.
So interesting.
There's a lot of research that somebody could do on that topic, like about like the Chinese community in Mexicali. But right now there's actually, I haven't read it, but there's a couple of historians who are like focusing on like Asian history along like the borderlands, right? So they like focus on the U.S. border states of like California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and then like Tamaulipas, Sonora, and Baja California. And actually like Sonora has like probably like the worst track record in terms of like ethnic Asian discrimination and events and stuff like that.
Something else that stuck out for me whenever you were talking about your family's motivations in moving was whenever you said the word disillusioned, you know, and how your family has felt that way. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, like my mom doesn't really feel like disillusioned that much. Like she's like very, and that's one of the things that like, one of the reasons that she doesn't feel disillusioned is because she's a citizen in the United States and Mexico. So she's able to get health care in Mexico and the United States. So she solicits services from the United States and Mexico. So she has like really great like health care. So she's able to see like specialists that she can't see in the United States and Mexico and vice versa. But my dad is more like disillusioned because, and I didn't know this until like I started like really like reading like history books and stuff, but like agricultural workers don't make overtime pay. So like my dad would work 60 hours and get paid like regular, like it wasn't until after 60. So the laws for overtime pay for agricultural workers differentiate between states. But agricultural workers, at least during that time period in California, they made overtime after 60 hours of work. So like my dad would work 60 hours without hitting overtime. So he would work Monday through Saturday, 12-hour shifts or 10-hour shifts. So he'd work. So he also did like, so not only did he work like in the field, but he also fixed like machinery and stuff like that. So like his overseer would tell him like, hey, this day you're going to be like picking crops. And then the next day you're going to be like doing mechanic work or whatever, right? So like my dad worked, he was born in 1945. I was born in 1992. So he like worked in agriculture until probably like 2011. So I think, so 10 years ago. So he's what, how old is he now? Yeah, so he stopped working in agriculture probably when he was like between 62 to 65. And one of the things that I like disillusioned him to was that, you know, as he got older, like the person that he was working for, like my dad would mess up sometimes, you know. And one day, like his boss got like really mad at him and he just fired him, like on the spot. And for the employer, I believe, to not give like unemployment to the worker, like, there needs to be like a track record, right, of like written documentation. So there was no like written documentation for like my dad like getting fired. So he fought. Like my sister was like, no, like you need to like fight this, right? And he was like, oh, sorry about this, my dog. So my sister was like, no, you need to fight that. Like you need to like solicit services from like a lawyer. So like after a while, like he was able to get like unemployment, but they also went to court. And like my dad was able to get like recompensated for his boss like unjustly firing him. So I think that like disillusioned him like a lot too. And then like he'll talk about like, he's like, yeah, like I kind of want to move back to like Sinaloa to like spend time with like my brother. He's like, but you know, I can't move because, you know, we have really good healthcare over here. He's like, but like I'm tired of like having to like work and do all of these things and stuff like that. So he'll say like, I had a lot of like bad things like happen to me for like your brother, your sister, and you to have like a better life. So that's why he was always like a really big advocate of me like moving over here to Texas, to like pursue my PhD. Because he was like, yeah, like maybe I'm like disillusioned, but you know, I did the sacrifice that way. You can do what you're doing right now. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you can reap all the benefits of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
A lot of the time, you know, like being a part of Jamal, I think about the generational wealth and not just like in finance, but emotional, mental, physical health. Having the option to work in a career that isn't like physically taxing, you know, thinking about how your dad was denied overtime for already working 60 hours, like that is ungodly. And like the way that immigrants can be treated sometimes in like a subhuman manner, it reminded me of this book I read in college called Braceros. I think it had like a subtext to it, but I remember that there were like Mexican workers that were being brought across the border to work here in Texas, and one of the landowners like sprayed them with like DDT.
Yeah.
And they would have like really invasive body checks to make sure that they didn't have lice, and like thinking that Mexicans could work harder with less water and resources and care because our skin was browner. like the brownness equated in their mind, it equated us to being able to work in the fields for a long hour, and the sun didn't impact us as much as someone who was white, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought about those things whenever you were talking about that. I mean, I can understand how your dad would become disillusioned after all of that process, you know, like coming here and being sold on the American dream and thinking that, like, if you work a hard day and, you know, like we really upsell capitalism and hard work. And it's just, oh man, look at what it can do, like the good and the bad. But you were going to say something.
No, I think, like, you know, acknowledging like these conversations, right, about like the United States, like history and stuff like that. Like one of the reasons that agricultural and service industry jobs, or like home care, like domestic care, one of the reasons that these jobs don't have like federal protections is goes back to like the New Deal, right? So like when the New Deal like established like the minimum wage and worker protections, they didn't protect like agriculture and domestic care because like during that time period, the Southern Democrats, right, which later on, you know, switched to become, you know, like the Republican Party, associated with the Republican Party, the Southern Democrats associated that work with the Black population. So because they, you know, wanted to create like things for workers under the New Deal, you know, they agreed to some of these protections, but they didn't agree to like protecting agriculture and domestic care because it was associated to Black labor, right? So I think like that's also like something like to acknowledge, right? About like these historical, to understand why, like why we're at where we're at, right? Where people who work in agriculture or people who work in who like bus tables, who take care of like people in their homes, right? People who take care of people in like nursing homes and stuff like that, like why they're not protected, right? So I think that's something that's like intersectional, right? Intersectional with like migration, Mexican history, United States history, and Black history. Yeah.
Tamal is very appreciative of your time today, Jonathan. Thank you so much.
Aquí estamos, porque acá fue donde nos puso la vida. Dejé todo, mis amigos, mi familia y mi ilusión. Y aunque allá he pasado los mejores años de mi vida, decir esto da tristeza, pero acá estamos mejor. Pero acá estamos mejor.